253 Road and Grand Avenue. That's reporting an order of smoke, private house.
So we have 32 and 360.
You missed box 2736, the address 1429.
All right, 10-4.
62 and 279, platter 32, platter 46.
Signal 34.
Hello and welcome to Reports from Racers, a product of the Christian Reagan-Hard Center for Emergency Response Studies at John Jay College of Criminal Justice of the City University of New York. The center is named for probationary firefighter Christian M.O. Reagan-Hard, who was killed in the collapse of the World Trade Center here in New York. The center is designed to be focused on policy concerns of the first responder community in response to large-scale events and broader issues of homeland security and the role of state and local first responders across the United States. We here at the Center began this podcast series to communicate on public safety policy and to provide a platform for airing views on emergency response issues across the disciplines of police, fire, emergency medical services, and emergency management. Finally, this podcast series is designed to inform the public and first responder community about ongoing research and education efforts of the Center. Hello, I'm Charles Jennings, Director of the Christian Reagan-Hard Center for Emergency Response Studies, RACERS, and host of today's podcast. Our topic today is intelligence sharing and dissemination. Our guests are all members of the Center's advisory board and distinguished public safety professionals and thought leaders. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily represent the policy of any of the guests' employers, agency, nor those of the Center. Our first guest is Dr. Theron Bowman. He's chief of the Arlington, Texas Police Department. Our second guest is Clark Kimmerer, deputy chief of the Seattle Police Department. And our final guest is Gordon K. Lee, a member of our advisory board. So thanks for being with me today.
Thank you, Charles.
The first question I think a lot of people have is, can we kind of lay out the structure of the intelligence community as it relates to state and local responders in the United States? And maybe we'll start with you, Clark.
Well, probably instructive to go back before 9/11 and talk about what we did by way of intelligence in the days before we had to basically change the paradigm. Mm-hmm. Most police agencies had intelligence sections or units principally involved in organized crime and other case-specific or crime-specific intelligence gathering. They didn't perform an enforcement function. They were essentially an investigative entity. And at the federal level, I'd say intelligence at a domestic, in the domestic arena, was dominated by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Since 9/11, I'd say the world has changed quite substantially, and in many ways probably for the better. We now are engaged in the creation of what are called intelligence fusion centers. Throughout this country, the term fusion is used deliberately. Heretofore, most intelligence was specifically the domain of law enforcement. Clearly, that is too limited a perspective to undertake the gathering of intelligence and sharing that information with all concerned, because fire and public health and the private sector and so many other entities have such a crucial role to play in the providing information as well as disseminating information products after it's been analyzed. The Bureau and the federal entities still exist and work alongside and are integrated into what are now 72 fusion centers at various stages of implementation and execution. They began and retained the form of joint terrorism task forces, which oftentimes include appointees or representatives of the local law enforcement and other public safety entities. And finally, and again for the first time, to my knowledge, in the wake of 9/11, we have a nexus between the analysis of information toward creating intelligence products, intelligence being actionable information, and the emergency management structure. Those are two totally separate endeavors for many, many decades. And now emergency management, disaster preparedness includes the component of intelligence, particularly when one considers that a disaster in the terrorism arena is the unique product of a malicious human intellect, unlike an earthquake, unlike a windstorm, but still has a place in, you know, how we manage disasters generally. So it's been a sea change to into a cocked hat. Very substantial structural changes, born of necessity. I suppose we're going to get into a little more detail about what's right and wrong about where we're at in that structural change. But that, to my point of view, is how things are organized right now, mm-hmm. broadly.
Okay.
Yeah, sure, Rob. Yeah, I'm Chief Bowman, and I'd like to hone in some on the local level and some of the local implications. Back before September 11, 2001, the philosophy for policing and gathering information and intelligence largely lied with the local agencies. And most local police agencies were engaging in community policing. Community policing, as designed, engaged members of the community with the idea in mind that if any intelligence type information developed, it would come from citizens who served as eyes and ears of the local police. After September 11th, the focus on intelligence on the national level really moved from local domestic type incidents to international incidents. And pretty quickly, we as a country ramped up to create a national infrastructure. And I think in a lot of ways, not totally forsaking, but somewhat to the detriment of the local level. And I believe community policing actually suffered some under that new structure. So today, just like 10 years ago even, I believe that most of what we know actually occurs at the local level. And much of what we should know but don't know is happening at the local level. So whereas our ability to understand what's happening overseas and what's happening across our borders has been greatly improved since 9/11, I believe there has been very little improvement in our ability to really understand what's happening in Mrs. Smith's neighborhood, you know, in the driveway and at the house around the corner and across the street. When you look at the local level, almost every municipality or county or local jurisdiction has its own records management system, if it has one, has its own telecommunications dispatch radio system, if it has one. And across the 18,000 law enforcement agencies in the country, there are huge disparities in our technology, equipment, and in our ability to interoperate and interrelate to one another. And so our grade at the very local levels where the rubber hits the road is pretty low. Mm-hmm. And I think we're standing at a point in time where we have a huge opportunity to not just try and reverse engineer an intelligence apparatus from federal down to local, but we can incorporate all of the different entities that Clark referred to, not just law enforcement and public safety, but incorporate local health and incorporate the local code compliance folks to this equation. Let's build this apparatus from the ground level up, and I think that's where we are today.
Okay, that's an excellent observation, and a couple of points we'll come back to. Gordon, can you lay out the kind of key players at the federal level in terms of intelligence as it relates to state and local first responders?
Sure, Charles. It really culminated from the 9/11 Commission report, That report generated a lot of discussion about how we're organized at the national level, and it had a lot to do with standing up the Directorate of National Intelligence, as we know it today. That's been in existence for about 5 years. It also stood up a few other intelligence-centric organizations, the National Counterterrorism Center being one of them, probably the most principal one in this discussion, simply because they were chartered to create an interagency effort for threat assessment, coordinating at the national level with FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, and others, in order to push information down to state and local levels. That process has been going on for a while, and it does have some warts, but the idea that it's been recognized as a necessity in order to get situational awareness, even down at the local level, to the point where threats outside of our borders and inside of our borders are recognized. And it allows the local law enforcement agencies, hopefully more so than they do right now, but the opportunity to have situational awareness and act in a preventative manner, hopefully before things even happen. The thing that I see most, one of the biggest challenges that I see in this is to make sure that the information that's passed down is of relevance. It holds information that can be acted upon, and it's of importance to that municipality. Now, a lot of times, things like security classifications get in the way, which is probably one of the biggest hurdles that you're going to have to overcome at the national level, getting information down to the local level. At the national level, you're trying to protect your sources of intelligence reporting, and you're trying to make sure that those sources are not put in harm's way. So that's probably one of the biggest challenges. Another big challenge between the agencies at the national level, coordination needs to be better than it is today. Information sharing is still difficult, although it's gotten better. The Directorate of National Intelligence has had a lot to do with that in some of the responsibilities he's taken on as far as information sharing across the agencies, like FBI and DHS and CIA. So I think that's getting better, but we still have a long way to go to make sure that we're keeping our U.S. population safe and secure.
Mm-hmm. And that's a major challenge, admittedly, in terms of the federal community. And the Director of National Intelligence still has to deal with these other agencies which retain their independence. Right, and so it's really a function of coordination and kind of soft power in terms of getting everybody working together.
That's very true, very true. He does have some resource decisions that help, mm-hmm. but you're right. Yeah. Each agency is a little autonomous in that regard. Mm-hmm.
Okay. But on that note, if you know, heaven forbid, we have to confront another tragedy, and we've come close and actually have seen around the world the kind of scenarios that we ourselves were victims of at 9/11. We have to, and I think we will, confront another catastrophic incident. I don't want the next 9/11 Commission report to highlight the fact that agencies retain their autonomy and have their own independent rules in terms of the sharing of information, and that for want of some administrative decisions, people were not granted security clearances that needed to have immediate access to important information. That would be unconscionable. And so I think the three of us here, and you, Charles, are kind of gathered as part of the Reagan Center, for example, to try and break those barriers down, to try and make sure that we don't end up, you know, engaged in the kind of horrific, you know, excuse that occurred 8.5 years ago.
Absolutely.
You know, there's a lot of organizational, legislative, legal issues. Certainly, it's come up in several of your comments. The structure of law enforcement, which is the leading entity in terms of intelligence in the United States, the vast number of law enforcement agencies that are out there, tremendous disparities that exist between them in terms of size, capabilities, capacities, interests, frankly, in some of these concerns. And from the analogy that you had made, Theron, about designing a system from the bottom up rather than the top down, and we look at this in many ways, I think the federal government has kind of been given this mantle of keeping the country safe, when in reality the vast majority of the resources are controlled by state and local governments. And we talked about, you know, and there's absolutely no expectation that state and local governments are under control of the federal government. And so we have a huge organizational, complex, messy problem in terms of resolving issues. But it brings to mind the whole issue of the the bottom-up design of the intelligence exercise, the intelligence enterprise, if you will. Do you want to elaborate a little more on that?
Sure. I wouldn't say to replace our current effort with the bottom-up design. I would say supplement our current efforts, because it is important that we have the infrastructure in place to understand what's happening internationally and to be able to act on that. But I think our biggest void or weakness is probably in our ability to collect and interpret information here domestically, so that police agencies in Texas that really are impacted by something that's occurring in Washington State would understand it. We need the ability to understand what's happening that impacts us wherever it's happening here in the country. We don't have that capability. We do have, as Clark indicated, 72 fusion centers. The information that we receive from the fusion center that's closest to us may be usable, maybe not. Maybe even probably not. It may help us understand something better than we might have, but probably not. It may be communicating with the fusion center 2,000 miles away, and maybe not. But still, each agency needs to be somehow plugged into this fusion center, this information, this intelligence network, and it's not happening. It's not happening because even at the local level, different departments within the same municipality don't know what's going on in the same municipality. And we need to collectively understand what's going on across the spectrum. So building a system from the ground up, from the federal perspective, I think would involve setting standards for telecommunications, setting standards for radio channels, radio frequencies, setting standards for systems designs, setting standards for records management systems, setting standards for the kinds of capabilities that our analysis engines will have, and then applying those standards to the systems that are designed by vendors so that they can be interoperable. Gordon talked about and Clark too talked some about the clearances. And we need to break down the barriers that's keeping the cop on the street from understanding critical information that he or she needs to know because of a security clearance issue. Not that they don't deserve to know, but because he or she hasn't gone through all of the loops to attain the clearance. Let's find another language that we can process that will apply where we can communicate this critical information across boundaries, across county and state and city boundaries. We need to do that. We don't have a common language. We don't have a common system. We don't have a common infrastructure. We don't have common standards. We need all of that. With a set of standards, then we can start to build out the systems that will apply across a common geography.
You absolutely are spot on. I got a military background, and interoperability was the key to success in every unit's accomplishment of the mission. Every time I was reassigned to another base or overseas, it was the interoperability piece that really made the difference, that we could talk to one another, that we all were playing off the same sheet of music, and that we all knew what the mission was all about, and all had essentially the same amount of information to do our jobs. Mm-hmm. That's
You know, I never thought I'd end up saying this. Three or four years ago, I'd be the last person on Earth, but I actually completely agree with Chief Bowman and with Gordon about the need to have standards, you know, to define systems of intelligence fusion. I'm not going to say that about a lot of the responsibilities and disciplines within Homeland Security. I think Chief Bowman said it very well, that to some extent one of our greatest challenges, namely the fragmentation and diffusion of populations and different jurisdictions, 17,000 plus, 18,000, that's our big challenge. Also one of our great strengths. I mean, we have relationships that states and the federal government can never attain. They're too distant. They're too infrequent in their engagement with people. But this is one area where I would say it's to our great benefit. We're down to our credit to all agree that here is what is a baseline process of intelligence fusion and information sharing. Here are the, you know, to the extent humanly possible. This is very costly, by the way. I haven't talked about that yet. Yeah. I wish I was waiting to hear Chief Bowman say not only that the federal government should establish standards, but also pay for the changes required to meet those standards. But you know, to be able to say and agree upon, you know, this is our way forward. Not to give up local control, but to have a general theory that enables us to connect the 17,000 plus different jurisdictions. So I'm in agreement. It's one of those, you know, I actually probably need to be deprogrammed because I never thought I'd say, you know, that we need a national vision of intelligence fusion. We have been working on that. Where we need to do a heck of a lot more work is making sure that this national vision is comprised of and constituted of the voices at the local level who have these relationships, who are accountable, because when we go home tonight, we're going to the house next door to Mrs. Smith and make sure that it is not in a federal vacuum that these are, you know, created. But I've come around about that, because I see this mosaic of fragments being created that will never be able to talk to one another, that will have varying states of capacity and capability, and which aren't going to necessarily serve our national interests or our local interests particularly well.
Well, that raises an excellent question, or that excellent point raises a question in terms of the structure of fusion centers. I mean, there's no one accepted model or standard for what a fusion center looks like, or how it should be staffed, or some of those things, right? It's still kind of something being resolved.
It's interesting because actually there is an emerging pattern of some essential of a fusion center. And, yeah, you can go into any one of the 72 official ones, and there's probably about 100 more others that are, you know, operate out of garages and things like that. But you'll find, I think, some common characteristics. One of the most important is the scope of mission argument and issue. Up to now, there's been a belief that a fusion center should be preoccupied with terrorism. And there's not a few that are still, you know, very much focused on terrorism. Fortunately, information doesn't come in with a little P, you know, attached to it. So the debate, and I think the movement, is now toward all crimes, all hazards. You'll probably go around the country and find that as one of the elements of that general theory we're talking about, that that's an agreed-upon objective about scope of mission. The governance of fusion centers, they can be all over the map, but I think there's general agreement there needs to be governance, and it needs to be inclusive, and it needs to, you know, make sure it reflects the, you know, people who are contributing, jurisdictions and agencies are contributing to the fusion center. The need for analysis and the emerging science of information analysis to create an intelligent product, starting to get a little more consistent. I mean, there's some features here. I actually would like to hear from, you know, Chief Bowman Gordon, if you're finding that there is some movement or some evolution toward a common understanding of what this thing called intelligence fusion is.
I think there is some movement towards the more of a common understanding. But I think the movement is very slow, and I think it's also largely frustrating because you have technology growing at the speed of light, and thus demands on the time of the consumers of this information, and the other demands are growing, in my opinion, faster than our ability to make this process of information dissemination more efficient. So it's becoming more and more frustrating to us consumers because we're not always getting out of the fusion centers the type and the quality of information that we need. Is there a movement? Certainly, there certainly is. Is it occurring fast enough? I don't think it is. Now, I don't believe every fusion center should have a common set of operating principles and practices and policies. But like Clark said, I think there should be a core set, and I believe there are more or less. But because jurisdictions are different, because regions are different, the mission of a tactical center in one region may be a little bit different. I mean, you would have a tactical fusion center that better accommodates the need in one area and a strategic center that better accommodates the need in another area. It doesn't matter which type you have as long as they adhere to a set of just a very core set of operating principles, as Clark alluded to, and that they have ultimately as a goal to make our country safer. And as long as they do that, I think they're on the right track. Gordon, what do you think?
Well, I don't know how much to add to those two comments. That was pretty inclusive. I would say the fusion center of any given region needs to be relevant to that region. It can't be it can't be run the same way in the state of New York as it's run in the state of Texas, because there are different issues, obviously, to what those regions are dealing with. I agree with Chief Bowman about really having a focus, not on so much a specific type of activity, but what's the objective? The objective is public safety. The objective is security. And, you know, what does that mean in the state of New York, for instance? Well, it's not just terrorism, although terrorism is on the forefront of every New Yorker's mind every day. But I think for the fusion concept to be viable, it has to be relevant. in its own district where it's covered. And, but I agree with Clark. They've got to have a common set of guidelines so that when you do have to go from fusion center across the region, there are similarities that everyone who's interacting with those various fusion centers knows they can go back and rely on and get information from.
Okay, it's another definition of interoperability.
Well, really? And then, which brings us to, Chief Bowman, you made the point earlier about standards and interoperability in terms of information exchange, and you alluded to the fact that all fusion centers don't necessarily speak the same language. They may not even speak to each other. And what's the role and status of developing information exchange standards among fusion centers and law enforcement in general? And I know, and we'll talk about the nuts and bolts of records management systems and radio interoperability, which most people, in my experience, in the public, assume those things have been solved years ago. But let's talk about data exchange between fusion centers. What are the issues there?
One is, you know, to not get too complex on this. Some fusion centers seek to justify their existence versus existing to meet the local demands. And those fusion centers that seek to justify their existence tend to push out information that I saw on CNN yesterday. They tend to use open source information and to some extent over massage it, over interpret it, and then offend people through their interpretation of open source information. And so it's almost like the boy who cried wolf. They put out stuff that's of really mediocre quality and do it so consistently that their relevance to their potential users become very small. And that's an issue.
Well, now you've raised that issue, and I think I can identify what you're talking about. And I guess the question that raises to me, is that a symptom of maybe we have too many fusion centers, or is that a breakdown in the dynamic between local law enforcement and the fusion center, that there is not a healthy exchange of information and maybe an understanding of local needs? What do you think that may be?
I don't think it's a symptom of too many fusion centers. I think we're still trying to find our way. We're still trying to find what works best, what's right for the country. So that's a part of it. But also, what we're seeing is a characteristic of not having a really good, solid set of standards that should apply to every fusion center operation. Once we fully understand what works and what doesn't, and apply that set of data to the fusion center operations that we choose to fund federally, I think we can eliminate some of the least relevant, more problem type fusion center operations. But a lot of it will require that we do much of what the Reaganheart Center is doing. We need to study and better understand these emergency response operations, study and understand the intelligence gathering processes. We need to ask the questions rationally, do, you know, the academic research so that we can fully understand what works and what doesn't, and then apply that to the decision-making matrices on whether a fusion center should be allowed to at least operate with federal funding. But we're not there yet. We still don't know, and we still don't know because it's a work in progress. And it's work in progress, thus hasn't truly been tested to the point where we have developed a reasonable set of rational standards to apply across the board.
I would very much agree with Chief Bowman. It's not, the question is not, are there too many fusion centers? And the quite, you know, in my experience, and in all candor, the mere existence of fusion centers in whatever number is a very good thing. It has been a remarkable kind of evolutionary process over a short period of time in a public safety enterprise that's not really often known for quick changes. And more to the point, intelligence fusion is our window on prevention. It is probably the single most important activity as law enforcement professionals, public safety professionals, we can engage in because it gives us the possibility not of having to respond to something horrible happening to innocent people, but to prevent it or at least mitigate it, to keep it to the lowest possible impact. And so that investment is immeasurably important. I think Chief Bowman and I also heard Gordon say the same thing. It's not the number, it's how they're functioning. It's the, you know, meeting objectives and having, you know, the kind of robust and legal and ethical and moral but effective process. And I would say that, though, to try and kind of amplify on Theron's answer, that we do have a challenge in that not only are there 72 state and local fusion centers, but alongside are Federal Bureau of Investigation, JTTFs, and the degree to which, and I'll make this a very bold assertion, the degree to which the local and state fusion centers are successful and efficacious is directly proportional to the degree to which the Bureau and the JTTFs have integrated their operations within them. When they stand alongside, and whether it's, you know, God forbid, competing, but at the very least, you know, two silos, I think you have a formula there for a pretty inefficient operation, the kind that just churns out open source information. But the ones that are able to, you know, take a little bite of humble pie maybe and fully integrate and cooperate and be open with one another, that's the formula that I see and is getting better, save for a few little false steps and backward steps. That's the key to me in taking these, you know, whatever number of fusion centers and making them life-saving enterprises.
Listening to my two colleagues, it just occurred to me, and there was a mention of reverse engineering earlier, how to reverse engineer this thing. And I'm thinking that the fusion center might be the key to this reverse engineering thought. They're getting national and higher level intelligence reporting down to them, and maybe what they should be doing is bringing the local information that's coming into them from the law enforcement agencies, from EMS, and what they're seeing from the fire departments, and actually, goodness gracious, fuse that information so that it's
relative. The same thing.
It's relative to this particular region. That is kind of where we need to be.
Well, that's a great point, and that brings us to the other big issue we have here, which is intelligence sharing beyond the realm of law enforcement. And this is an issue that there clearly are not a lot of stellar examples out there, but how do we break down those barriers in light of all the issues of classification, all the issues of law enforcement sensitive, and what are the models or what's the way forward for getting beyond basically a cop shop and making this something that's going to speak to, in terms of two-way dialogue, of letting you know from the fire service or EMS or other agencies of local and state government that there's something going on out there that, that may be crucial for you to know. And that's out to Chief Kimmerer. You want to take a shot?
That's a very complicated question. Chief Bowman?
Yeah, sure, sure. I'll start on this one. I don't mind because I've been in police work now about 27 years. I can talk about the pros and the cons, positives and the negatives. And I don't think anybody in police work can deny that we in policing have had long-standing reluctance to work with people outside of law enforcement. But I had an opportunity a few weeks ago to meet with and sit and talk to some corporate executives, some corporate security people in the private sector. And what I understood from meeting with them is that corporate America wants to be safe. Corporate America, private sector, to a large degree, has the discretionary funding to help law enforcement address this issue of information intelligence and overall public safety. And I think we have to reach out to the private sector, to our responsible retailers, to corporate America, corporate security, and bring the private sector into the fold more so than what we've been willing to do. They really are our partners. There were citizens who worked in private corporations whose lives were lost 9/11. Just like the firefighters, the public, the police officers, the public safety workers. And so we all have an interest in this equation. We, I think, in policing have to be assertive in looking at ourselves and reaching out to corporate America, private security, and then to other stakeholders, not be so inwardly focused and not so cynical. I mean, we have to be safe. We have to be careful. We have to exercise scrutiny. We have to be diligent in making sure that we don't make mistakes in sharing intel and information with the wrong people. But at the same time, our team looks different. Our partners are different, and I think it is incumbent upon us to understand and accept the new configuration of this team, because the other team members have what we need, and we have what they need, and we have to stop playing keep away from each other.
I think the desire is there. I mean, I agree with you. We have this kind of natural reticence to, you know, share all information. Obviously, when there's some, you know, disaster coming, it's incumbent on all of us on the emergency management side as well to make public information, provide public information. But I think the willingness is there. There's some challenges in the execution. I mean, if I come to Arlington and say I need to talk to the police chief, well, that's one person. I know who it is, and we can have a conversation that's, you know, relevant and on point. Who speaks for the public sector? I mean, that's a huge kind of assemblage of interests and people, some of them not necessarily thinking the same way, some of them competing with one another. I know that we've made inroads through the process of analyzing critical infrastructure and doing vulnerability assessments to building those relationships, and maybe that's a good starting point, you know, when that oft-repeated statistic that the private sector controls 85% of the critical infrastructure in this country. Well, that's very revealing. And so the relationship that we as public safety professionals have in assessing vulnerability in critical infrastructure starts and really ends with our relationship with those property managers and owners and the security staffs that, you know, make sure that those areas are safe. The question of sharing information is critical, and part of it is systematic, how one creates a system of information sharing. I mean, heretofore, we you know, would just call up the people we knew. Well, that's a pretty long list right now, and that may not be the way that we want to, you know, communicate anyway. I understand that there's some programs. I think Atlanta has a program of supplying pagers. Actually, they're paid for by the private sector. I may be wrong about this, but I've heard that they communicate during emergencies or when there's absolute critical information to convey via the paging system that is a direct link between the police department and the those who are carrying the pagers that are, you know, kind of supplied or that they pay for. There's outdialer systems. Those tend to be emergency only and fairly limited. Do you know any others, T, that you've heard about?
I've heard about several cities that have kind of brought in the private sector, especially corporate security, and have created communication awareness kinds of systems, mm-hmm. where they're notifying and to some extent actually training with private security for critical incidents. So I am aware of some of those.
Those are I think two critical areas. One is joint training. Mm-hmm. Again, you're going to run into that problem of, well, who do you invite, and whoever's left off the list is going to let you know about it pretty fast.
Absolutely.
The other is strategic planning.
Absolutely.
Which I think we're starting to do more and more of, and is long overdue.
Yeah. Absolutely. So anyway, we have the technology now, and I've seen it in use. In fact, at this last Super Bowl in Miami, there was a system that users who logged into the system gained access to information based on their login. And so you could only see the amount of information that you had a right to based on your unique login name. A system like that can be used to share information with the private sector, as well as information throughout the ranks of public safety and the public, where people who have a right to know can have information pushed to them, and then that information that they don't have a right to know can be retained in secure areas of the system. So we do have that capacity even today as I speak. And that may represent an opportunity to bring some others of our partners on board and communicate across a broader spectrum of people with our same interest.
Okay.
I was going to suggest one other thing about the importance of the private sector. And you know, that they're going to bring things to the table that they need, their requirements, which would be another generating factor for what the fusion center should be looking at, and the local law enforcement, local PD, local fire department. For instance, cyber attacks is really big right now. It could be devastating to the private sector. Maybe something that the fusion center takes a look at. There could be other things like power grid attacks or power grid disruption, which could have a devastating attack. I just wanted to throw that out there because those are other avenues that the Fusion Center could be looking at to thwart any type of threat in those areas as well.
Yeah, that you make a great point, Gordon. And that reminds me, I had an opportunity to look at some of the kinds of technology that corporate security employs. And that convinced me that the private sector has some technology that law enforcement could use. And so this partnership is not a one-way partnership where we're giving them everything by any means, but there is a lot that they contribute and a lot that we can receive and apply based on what's standard practice today in the private sector. So I agree with you 100% there.
Well, it's, our closing question, I guess, would be looking at across all the issues that have come up over this great discussion, and we could certainly go on, what do you think the key contributions or needs for research What's the role of academics in trying to support and resolve some of these concerns? And so we'll just go around the table. Gordon, we'll start with you.
I'd like to really, I'm hung up on disseminating information to the people who need it, and I'm hung up on, and it's more of a institutional process that's kind of constipated, and that's the classification structure. It would be good to analyze that, see what really constitutes a threat to our nation's security by passing information down. Give judgment on a sound procedure to get it down to the local levels, who needs the information, in order to make sure that their first responders have what they need. That's one of my biggest suggestions for what we could do.
Okay, great. Chief Bowman?
One of the most compelling presentations I've seen since I've been a part of this advisory board was a look at the movement in Philadelphia, and to understand from the perspective of the firefighters and the EMS people on scene how the police were perceived. We quite often are victims, I guess I could say, of our own culture and of our own perspective, and don't fully understand how our operation integrates into the entire public safety mission. I think it's very, very important that we continue the emergency response studies, but that we help to educate all of the components of this emergency response system on each other's responsibilities, on how we all fit together in this system, and through understanding each other's needs and requirements, we develop interoperability, we develop understanding, we develop the ability to want to work together, to want to create the outcomes where our public can be safe anywhere all the time. So I think more than anything else, it's you know, be that conduit of studies and information, put it out here so that we can train and improve ourselves, tell us what the facts are, tell us what is and is not the case, and help us to understand what we can do better. And as we do that, we're working on interoperability, we're training together, we're doing the things that ultimately will keep us safe in the future.
Okay, thanks. Chief Kimmerer?
My mother often told me that nothing good comes from having a single perspective. And it seems to me that in this debate, some of the issues of which we've been exploring this afternoon, there's the perspective of the police, there's the perspective of the fire department, there's the perspective of the state emergency management, there's the perspective of the federal government, all isolated, all probably very thoughtful, and to the extent that they can, each representative can make it, objective and representing, you know, the complexities of the issues. But the plain truth of it is that there is no substitute to having rigorous, multi-perspective, analytical, objective, third-party analyses of complicated issues. And that seems to me to be the hallmark of the academic institutions. And I would welcome that. I think that the great universities have been left out of the debate, or they're kind of brought in, you know, at the 11th hour, perhaps with a view toward, you know, either validating or repudiating whatever the decision has been that's already been made. But I think, you know, to get us out of what we've been describing here is something of a fragmentary, inconsistent, not altogether well-defined enterprise, something as important as intelligence fusion. that the integration of the institutions of academia with the methodologies of analysis and double-blind testing and all this other stuff, which I can, you know, barely understand myself. You know, I don't go to a professor for, you know, instruction on SWOT tactics, but then again, he's not coming to me for, you know, structuring a study methodology. Mm-hmm. And that's the point,
right,
that we're all in this together, and I think that we're on a fool's errand if we leave out, you know, the value of the impartial, analytical, academic perspective in trying to keep the country safe. As Chief Bowman and Gordon both said, that's what we're about here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much. I'd like to thank all of our guests who were with us today and took time away from the advisory board meeting. Deputy Chief Clark Kimmerer of the Seattle Police Department, Chief Theron Bowman, Arlington, Texas, and Gordon Lee of the Reagan-Hard Center Advisory Board. I'm Charles Jennings, Director of the Christian Reagan-Hard Center. And Reports from Racers is a production of the Reagan-Hard Center for Emergency Response Studies at John Jay College. We'd like to thank the Department of Audiovisual Services for their assistance in production of this podcast, and the content should be used with citation and can be distributed freely. Donations to support the center are tax-deductible and can be made care of the John Jay College Foundation, 899 10th Avenue, New York, New York, 10019. Thank you for listening.